Did you enjoy visiting the cave today? And see that sometimes, as a monk, you have to sometimes do lots of work, sometimes you travel, and sometimes they put you, I don't know, even now I ask the Buddhist Fellowship, please put me up in a small, or put me out in a small room for executive retreats. But they can't do that because even the personnel in the hotels, they say, oh, you're a monk, you're a senior monk. They have to give you the best room in the hotel. And I don't know why they do that. But anyway, remember the last time I went on one of these executive retreats, and they put me, it's not the last time, the time before, they put me in a big room with a sea view. And so I just went in there, had a look through the window, saw all these semi-naked Western girls. And I closed the curtains, and I never looked through the window again until we were leaving. Anyway, the mountain view, yeah. No, just give me the mountain view. No, just give me the no view, the Nimitta view, so I can look inside. But anyway, so the cave is always really nice to remind me I'm just a monk. Keep it nice and simple in there. It's very quiet as well, so you can't hear what's going on outside. So if the monks go crazy, if there's people coming a whole heap, I can lock those two doors and you can't get me out, which is great, with some solitude. So anyway, do the Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. So we're now coming to the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, the jhanas, otherwise known as samadhi. And samadhi has many different translations, but the one which really fits is not concentration, because that is what you have to do through force. It is stillness, which is what you do through letting go. You can imagine, just you relax. All the muscles are getting loose, peaceful. So the mind, the body, because it's still, can vanish. And parts of the mind vanishes as well. So you get very still. That is by far the best English description of stillness. And how was a few years ago, we had a professor from Stanford, Chinese professor. She would come here for the 3 month range retreat. And when she heard me say this, she said, of course. And she was Chinese, and she said, when the Chinese Agamas, they never call samadhi concentration. The Agamas are the equivalent to the suttas. It's always stillness. So, if you change it from concentration to stillness, then not only do you understand what this stage is, but you also have a far greater chance of experiencing it. It's not what you do, it's what happens when you stop doing things. And one of the great similes of Ajahn Chah, which I haven't mentioned yet in this retreat, but which I heard, forgot, and later on sort of remembered and thought what a wonderful simile that was. And that was a simile of the mango garden, or the mango orchard. And he said that simile when I first went to Wat Pa Pong, 74, 75. And anyway, that he would repeat similes and then forget them, and This particular simile was, he said, his monastery was like a mango orchard where the trees, the mango trees, were being planted by the Buddha. So it was a simile. And he said that all the mango trees are mature and is full of mangoes, almost on every branch and twig, hundreds of delicious, juicy, ripe mangoes. But, he said, to get one of those mangoes, you can't throw a stick up to get them to fall. They will never fall. You can't climb the tree to reach those mangoes or get a ladder. No ladder is high enough. There's only one way that you can't shake the tree either. There's only one way to get those mangoes, incredibly delicious, only one way to get those mangoes, and that is to sit perfectly still under the tree and hold out your hand and a mango will fall. And that's what he said. Sit perfectly still under the mango tree and open your hand and a mango will fall right into it. And of course that made absolutely no sense to me at all. As for many people, when they first hear it, they say, well, what are you talking about? You know, you have to do something to get a mango to fall. If you just leave it on the trees, the birds will get it way before it will fall. You've got to climb, shake, or get a cherry picker, or get something to get those mangoes. And the idea of sitting under a tree and thinking a mango is going to fall, I say, if it does fall, because of our luck, it'll probably fall on your head rather than your hand. So how does this actually work? It doesn't make any sense to me. But then later on, when you started learning about meditation, and you strived and struggled, just like the Buddha did or the Bodhisattva did for, I don't know, 6 years after you left home. Struggled and striving, lots of effort, trying everything, and nothing working. And sometimes we try something else. Letting go. Being still. And he said, this is the way you get the mangoes to fall. So it was absolutely true. You sit perfectly still. Opening up your hand, to me, meant opening up your heart. The kindness. And stillness. And then all these incredible states of mind will come. Sometimes, you know, not fast, but they come. You start to see nimittas. And some of you already, you know, say, oh, was it a real nimitta? Was it a light? No, from the windows or something? 99% of the time it really is a nimitta. And what really interests me is, why is it people, when they see these things, say, no, it can't be. Not me. I'm only a lay person. I'm not sort of a monk. I don't meditate that much. Doesn't matter. If you sit still enough, the mangoes start to fall. And we get the nimittas, get beautiful nimittas. We have to be very, very still. And then these jhanas happen. Keep being still. And then the enlightenment stuff happens and all this stuff happens. You go chasing it and you don't get anywhere. So this is the stillness. And what Ajahn Chah used to say. Sit perfectly still under the boat, under the mango tree. Open up your hand and the mango will fall. And this is the story, starting off from Majjhima 36. The Arya Pariyasana Sutta, it's the Noble Search. One place in the suttas where the Buddha talks about his history, how he became enlightened. I remember a time when my father was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. Having passed beyond the five senses and free from unwholesome states, I entered and abided in the first jhana. I thought, could that be the path to enlightenment, Bodhi? Then the realization arose that jhana is indeed the path to enlightenment. So that's a very strong statement, and it's very well known in so many traditions. You know, you probably may have seen movies of the Buddha's enlightenment, or plays depicting the Buddha's enlightenment, and that's one of the key things in it, where the Buddha, as a kid, was under the rose apple tree, where his father was supposed to be only 7 or 8 years of age, and that's when he entered the first jhana spontaneously. Didn't know what he was doing, but that's what happened. Do you think a 6 or 7, 8 year old kid could concentrate? How many of you have been teachers and you tell a kid, concentrate? It's not what they're doing when they're just sitting under a Bodhi tree. If in those days they would have had these things, iPads or tablets or video games, he would have never achieved that. He'd be playing some video game under the rose apple tree while he was bored. But here he manages to let go and get into a jhana. And later on, this occurred, this thought, after he had done all his ascetic practices, after he had been with Avalara Kalama and Uttakaramaputta, those two teachers, when nothing worked, when he had explored all options and still wasn't anywhere near enlightenment, that's when he remembered that. Perhaps that is the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment. And again, the insight came that jhana is indeed a path to enlightenment. So there's a powerful statement. But to get that jhana, you can't just decide, I'm going to go get a jhana. All those other factors, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, are also important to get the jhanas. Support it. And so that was one of the reasons why that, well, actually didn't, I should actually put that in here. But in a Maha, in the sort of the Aryaparyasana Sutta, the Buddha said, but it's not easy to get a jhana with such an emaciated, weak body, because he'd been fasting for a long time. So he carried on in this sutta. What if I relax, rest, bathe, have proper food, and then when I feel strong again, then may I try to get these jhanas? Or because he said it's not easy to achieve, or rather experience, a jhana with such a weak body. And that's why that in the story he rested, he bathed, he had a good meal, and he found a wonderful place, Bodh Gaya. Just, that wasn't called Bodh Gaya then, it was called Uruwela. And there he found this beautiful meadow by the river Nirjala and sat under a cool tree. And there he became enlightened. Oh, he had a wonderful meal, first of all. A meal from Sujata. It was meant for a heavenly being. But he took it and ate it. A good meal, cool shade, pleasant place. And that's where he could get these enlightenment. And his first 5 students, when he stopped his ascetic practice, when he started eating properly, sleeping properly, instead of forcing his mind and forcing his body, they gave up on him. They thought that how can you become enlightened through just sitting down in a comfortable place and blissing out? So that's not the way to enlightenment, they thought. And so they left him, they abandoned him. It wasn't a proper practice, an accepted practice in that time, amongst those spiritual seekers, to eat well and sleep well, and not indulging, but just comfort. So it was a different path which the Buddha took. And that's why at first those 5 disciples thought, how could he become enlightened? How could he get anything when he gave up his asceticism? It's a very important point. In order to get these jhanas, you need a comfortable room in a quiet cottage with a nice soft bed and great food. and a kind teacher. Otherwise it doesn't work. There is a reason why I designed this place. We did have an architect, but I fought with that architect verbally. I said, no, we want it this way. And all the people who were raising funds for this, we can't afford to have en suites, you know, because it's too expensive. So no, we're going to have en suites. We can't do it. Said, we're going to have en suites. Can't do it. Every room has an en suite. And you know what that does? It makes it very comfortable. And it's not to indulge, it's to relax and find some peace and get some good meditation and even nimittas and jhanas. There's a reason for this. So, could that be the path to enlightenment? It is indeed the path to enlightenment. So, what are these four jhanas? Having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses. Now that's something that even the Hindus understand that one. But still some of the Buddhists keep on saying, oh, it means vivicchayi kammehi. Vivicchayi means really free, you know, apart, secluded, for the time being. You know, it's not a permanent shutting down of your five senses from this word karma, kammehi. And it doesn't say karma sukehi, not being free from the five sense pleasures. It means the five senses. The senses stop. Seeing stops. Hearing stops. Smelling, tasting, and the physical touch stops. Those five senses cease for a little while. And that's one of the important parts of the four jhanas. You are totally, totally free from these five senses. It doesn't mean you're totally free from attachment to the five senses. Yeah, I can hear, but I'm not bothered by it. Yeah, I can feel, but I'm not really interested in it. No, it means they're gone. They're beyond your consciousness. There was this one gentleman years ago, and he was in the British Army. Now, but he had suffered from terrible migraines. And when he was on on exercises, he said, and it was in West Germany, that he was, I think, a warrant officer, a sergeant or something. And so he was in charge of a group of soldiers, and every time he had a migraine, he'd always try and find a quiet, dark place. And he said he never knew much about Buddhism or meditation. The only way he could escape from the pain and discomfort having a very throbbing migraine was go right into the center of it. And he said where, you know, he couldn't feel things anymore. You know, the pain actually drove him into a deep meditation. And he told me one day, which confirmed to me that, you know, he was doing these jhanas, because one day he was on some exercise and the radio message came in, this was a long time ago, have a break, 15 minutes, have a tea break. So all his soldiers had a tea break, he had a splitting migraine, headache, migraine. He saw a little barn close by. So he said, you have your tea, I'm going in the barn to deal with my headache. So off he was in the barn, and soldiers being soldiers, they had their tea. And after they'd finished, they got in their lorry, their truck, and off they went down the road. And so one of them said, oh my goodness, we forgot Sarge. They forgot the sergeant. So they turned around, went into the barn, and he was sitting there perfectly still. So they picked him up and put him in the back of the truck, you know, like soldiers do. Soldiers are not the most sensitive of people. So it must have been like quite sort of, you know, disturbing, but he didn't know anything of it. And he said later on, you know, halfway down the road, he came out of his meditation and said, I was in a barn, I'm in a truck now, what happened? And the soldiers said, I just picked you up, Sarge, because you're doing your thing, and you were just, you know. So they knew that he was in deep meditation, but he couldn't feel himself being picked up, He couldn't hear the sound of the truck starting. These were the old days, the trucks were very loud. And there was a sign. This is what happens when you get into those deep meditations. You can't hear, you can't even feel the body. So that's the sign of being free from the five senses. And free from unwholesome states, the hindrances, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana. Now these jhanas have got slightly different tastes. The first jhana is, if you are not aware of the body, what are you aware of? And what the mindfulness is aware of is like bliss, ecstasy. But that ecstasy in the first jhana is slightly unstable. In other words, it just occupies your mind. It's very difficult to leave it, I'm not quite sure if I can explain this to your satisfaction, but the mind is still holding onto that object. It holds it. And because it holds it, that's why it's unstable, and it moves away. But the bliss is so strong, it pulls you back in again. It's what I call the wobble of the first jhana. It's not perfectly still, but you're never that far away from the object of bliss. It's not strong enough to sort of take you into the five sense world. So that becomes that first jhana. The mind moves on to the object and holds on to it. The object being joy and pleasure. You can't sort of distinguish the two. And its cause, where that joy and pleasure comes from, being totally free from the five senses. Oh, at last, these five senses, which are a burden. It's like having five bags you're carrying, all full of heavy rocks, and you put each one of them down so that you're free. You're free of the five senses. And this is not something which is just experienced by Buddhists. Hindus have done this since. Not before, though. And so have, it looks like, you know, the people like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila. These were Christian saints in the time of the 13th century. And you know, you read some of what they described. I don't know about the translation, because I only could read the English translation. But as much which they said there, we said that could very much have been a jhana experience, especially Teresa of Avila, because she would levitate. And you know, during the prayers, sometimes the other nuns had to catch her by the legs so she didn't get sort of caught up in the rafters of the church. And they weren't sort of joking. These things happened. We've got huge amounts of energy and bliss. We didn't know what the body was up to. Because, you know, you weren't aware of it, you were deep inside the mind. And the other thing, which, again, you notice where these things come from and how they are seen from the other religions. It was in Psalm 36 in the Christian Bible, where it said, "Be still and know that thou art God." And what the heck does that mean? But if you've, know what the jhanas are, you're so still. You have got this incredible amount of power and bliss. But you, as you recognize yourself, your sense of ego, self, me, is gone. So much power comes from stillness. And I imagine that people who have been brought up in that Christian religion would say straight away, oh yeah, that's union with God. And in fact, even with the modern Hindu path. There was a teacher called Satchananda, is a guru. And because I would meet some of his disciples and ask what they were up to and how they practiced, they said what they were doing was they were, through their meditation, through their stillness, trying to achieve what they called the blue pearl nimitta. So now a very deep blue nimitta inside their mind. And if they could merge into that blue pearl nimitta, then they were enlightened. For me, wonderful, but it's only first jhana. More to come. Ajahn Brahm is just such a hard teacher. You know, think, okay, I can get enlightened, but it's not enlightenment yet, it's just a deep meditation. But anyway, I'm sure I'll tell this, and if anyone had a nimitta and got into a jhana, if you were in, say, a Christian religion, you know, that's how you describe it. Union with an ultimate blissful, peaceful, joyful, that's how people would experience it and say it. And they would name a church after you, or a hospital. You'd have Saint Eileen's, because you'd be a saint. And then that's what happens. Unfortunately, we don't become saints. But this is where you're blissed out, totally free from the five senses. And that's actually the first jhana. This is actually big stuff. It's great spiritual mountains have been scaled. There is more to come, which is incredible. You'd assume, after you come out of the meditation, inside the meditation, you're just blissed, ecstasy. You can't move that much. First jhana is the wobble, but it's not much of a movement. You can't analyze it. You analyze it afterwards, when you come out. What the heck was that? Because it's a powerful experience, super mindful, then you can really remember it so easily. And you can examine it afterwards. It's called Pachawekana Jnana, the reviewing wisdoms. And if you have the first jhana, you think, my goodness, it can't be anything higher than that. That's the peak. And then you carry on meditating, and it goes deeper. You find, oh my goodness, there's another mountain higher than this. The second jhana. So in the first jhana, five things are absent, five factors are present. When one has entered the first jhana, the five hindrances are totally absent. So let's go through those hindrances. The karma chanda is like the basically interest, almost the attachment, the consent to be in this world of the five senses. You know, of the body. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. And the aversion, which sometimes comes up. And obviously, the restless, oh, the sloth and torpor. The dullness. Obviously, these jhanas, these are really high energy states. No way they have tiredness, sloth and torpor. You really are. You can't go to sleep. You're bright, happy. And also the restlessness. High energy, but poised. It just, everything becomes very still. And also the doubt. Strange though, in these jhanas, you have no, doubting is a movement of the mind. When you come out of these jhanas, that is one of the most real experiences you'll ever have. So, those five hindrances are totally absent. And what is present, again, the mind moving onto the object, holding on to it, that's the vitakka vichara. The object being the joy and the pleasure, and it was oneness of mind. So it's an incredibly happy state. When the mind no longer moves onto the object, because it lets go of holding onto it, in a couple of places they have a one and a half jhana, between the first and the second jhana. That is when, this is just a metaphor, simile, you're holding on to that bliss, and then you realize you don't need to. Oh, sorry. You don't need to, so you lessen your grip on it. If you lessen your grip on it, it means that the mind does not move away. So the vitakka just disappears. It doesn't move away, so it doesn't need to go back onto it again. But you're still holding on slightly. And then when you totally let go, and the reason is because you trust. You don't need to hold on. And then you have what we call the second jhana. The mind doesn't move at all. Still solid like a diamond, like a mountain. When the mind no longer moves onto the object because it lets go of holding onto it, you enter upon the abide in the second jhana, which has trust, the sampasadana, in the object, the bliss, enough to let go of holding it. Just let it be, and it stays. Doesn't go anywhere. You know what it's like when you're meditating? Sometimes you get, well, many people have said this already, they're getting into a nice state of meditation, and there's a sort of fear there that you've got to hold on to it, otherwise it'll disappear. It's so nice. And you mess up because you try and keep it. If you don't try and keep it, it will stay with you. If you try and keep it, it will disappear. It's just a coarse action coming from you to try and hold things. So that is the last bit of holding on you'll do in the jhanas. In the first jhana, then you totally let it go. And it stays. It doesn't go anywhere. So when the mind no longer moves onto the object, because it lets go of holding onto it, you enter upon, okay, the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss enough to let go of holding it, and a unity of mind without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. This is here, you're free of this mind, which always moves. Here it's absolutely still. You can't do anything, you don't do anything. You know, to do things is a lot of suffering. And sometimes we're just used to doing something, used to going places. To actually be totally still, to be here, really be here, not moving at all. Just the mind, just the body vanished, and just the mind being here and not moving. That is incredible bliss. And what's the insight from that is your will has stopped. The thing which you recognize as choice, will, is gone. Comes back again afterwards, unfortunately, but at least right now, you sit here, can't move. I'm not talking about the body, the mind, totally still.
What do they mean by oneness of mind?
Aha, yeah. This ekagata, thank you. Ekagata, they call it oneness of mind, but eka is one, ta means ness. And the word, the important word, is the middle word, agga. And agga means, like, not just oneness, but it's like one peak of mind, one summit of mind. Many people know the word agga from its Sanskrit version, Agra. Have you ever been to Agra? In south of Delhi? It was the Red Fort, Taj Mahal. That was the capital, the peak of power in the Mughal Empire. So, of India. It was the peak, the summit of that empire. It is, Agra is like the peak, it's a summit. It's not just an ordinary oneness, it's a high summit of the mind. And, as I said, that simile of going to the peak of a mountain. And it's amazing when you get up there and then you find there's another mountain, it's a higher. It doesn't matter, you go up to that one as well. They're all oneness of mind. And it's also not just the oneness of even space. We always think of oneness almost like a focus into a point. But this is also a oneness in time. Not space, but also time. Because in that state, you're just here. It's like one moment. And after a while, you come out, and 3 hours have gone past. Is that right? Is the clock wrong? But it's right. The time has no meaning. If you look at time, what it is, time is always a measurement between the past and the present, between the present and the future, or between the past and the future. If two of those has gone, especially if you're just in the present moment, when there's no perception of past, when there's no perception of the future, you're just here, I mean really here, in this moment. Time has no meaning. Hours go past and have they gone past? You've been here all the time. So there's a oneness in time as well. Yeah, you've meditated for 3 or 4 hours, but it's only been a moment. So, it's oneness in time as well. And, it gets the joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. And remember what I was saying, that when things are still, things start to fade away. If you don't click your mouse on this thing, sometimes that happens, I'm talking too much and I forget to scroll or something, and this thing goes blank. When the mind is still, things start to vanish. So, in that second jhana, totally still, something vanishes. And what actually vanishes is the half of what you recognize as bliss, the coarser part. So you think in the second jhana, this is, wow, amazing. We don't think that, but you know, that's what you think afterwards. But then that bliss changes. Half of it disappears. Instead of the pity, you have the sukha. Sometimes it's like being a connoisseur of ecstasy. Not just the first jhana, but the second. And the third, it's even more blissful. And then the fourth jhana, then the sukha disappears. Oh, I should actually say what the Buddha said here. With the fading away of joy, you abide, mindful and fully aware. Experience of bliss purified from joy. You enter upon an abiding, the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, one has a pleasant abiding indeed, who has such mindfulness and equanimity. The reason they put that down there is pleasant. These aren't sort of stages where it's any suffering whatsoever, but you have mindfulness and equanimity. You're aware, you're not blanked out, you're not in a trance. And that is emphasized even in the fourth jhana. Having abandoned all pleasure and pain, this is not what you do to go from the third to the fourth. This describes, you know, the last of the jhanas. Having abandoned pleasure and pain, which is all Vedana from the five senses, all experience from the five senses, and the disappearance of joy and unhappiness, which is all the experience from the mind, the sixth sense, except for equanimity, contentment, peace, stillness. And that sixth sense, that's all that's left. You enter upon the abiding in the fourth jhana, which is only neutral mental experience remaining. Just pure mindfulness with equanimity. And that is stated to be here. It is the highest mindfulness you can ever get. This is the peak of mindfulness. Really super power mindfulness. Right there, without being disturbed by any of the five senses. Joy or unhappiness, so joy or suffering from the mind. Just there. Peaceful, equanimous, but incredibly mindful. That becomes the fourth jhana. And this is what the Buddha said here, the pure mindfulness. Because some people think, oh, yeah, in these jhanas you're just zonked out, you're not aware at all, you're just in a trance, it's like being unconscious, like it's having an anesthetic. It might appear to people on the outside that's what's happening, but on the inside, having a great deal of bliss and happiness. And of course, there was a little story of Greg. Long time ago, I haven't seen him for a while. But he was the one who, this is why I say anyone can do these things. He was this ordinary sort of guy who was one Sunday afternoon, there's nothing on the TV, so he decided to go into his bedroom to meditate, usually only half an hour. And then, after about an hour, his wife went in to check on him. He was still meditating there. He never usually stays for such a long time. But she looked at him closely. His chest wasn't moving up and down. There was no breath. He stopped breathing. So what did she do? She rang 000 here, not 999 in Singapore. 000, which is the emergency number. And the ambulance, it was a Sunday afternoon, they didn't have many calls. The ambulance came within about 5 minutes. And the medics, they ran into the room. And they said he wasn't breathing. And these were trained medics. They took his pulse. No pulse. His heart wasn't discernible. So they put him in the ambulance, in the gurney, his wife was freaking out, and they rushed him to the hospital, and I threw all the red light, really fast, bumping along the road, and that's not just for effect. There's a reason I say that, bumping along the road, and as soon as he got to the hospital, straight into the emergency, triage had a look at him, put on ECG and EEG, flatliners. Both were flat. Okay. Exactly. Thank you for that visual effect. Or that sound effect. It's just right. He was dead. And the wife was, you know, told me all the story afterwards because, you know, that she was, actually the wife told the husband who told me, because, you know, to all intents and purposes, he was dead. And, you know, he would usually have been sent straight down to the morgue. But there was one or two reasons which kept him in the emergency room. And that was that his wife had told him he got into this state through meditation. He had no history of any cardiac problems. And the doctor happened to be, his parents had migrated to Australia from India. And so his parents had heard, and he had heard from his parents, that sometimes yogis can go into this deep state of meditation where they can suspend all their life activities. So he thought, who knows, maybe this is a meditation state. And the one weird thing about this case, even though his body, there's no sign of life, his body remained warm. And if you look in the Chulavedala Sutta, that's what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. The difference between someone who's dead and someone who's in deep meditation is their body remains warm, it doesn't get cold. So please remember that. If myself, Rajan Bhamari, when he goes over to Singapore, if he's just sitting there, you look at him and there's no sign of life. If his body's still warm, don't cremate him yet. He's just meditating, that's all. But that's what happened. This fellow, they, according to his wife, they gave him defibrillators to try and get the heart going again. Apparently, and some doctor in Singapore said, you don't do that anymore, they give injections adrenaline, yeah, to try and get him going. But his wife said, no, it was they gave him the defibrillators many times. Nothing worked. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. Just like when you wake up in the morning. It's hard to wake up. But, you know, he opened his eyes and the ECG, EEG were perfect. They started working perfectly. And the doctor was, you know, stunned. And, you know, they gave him a thorough examination, couldn't find anything wrong with him at all. So he was so fit and healthy after this that the doctor let him walk home with his wife. They did not keep him in overnight for observation. Why? There's nothing wrong with him. And he said, all that time he was perfectly mindful. He was aware. He wasn't sort of unconscious, but there was a great bliss inside his mind, the best bliss he's ever had. The sound of the ambulance, da 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 da, he never heard that. You know, the sound of the medics wheeling him in, or just going around the corners, swerving around vehicles to get to the hospital in time, he never felt that. He never felt even defibrillators on his body. Didn't feel anything, except bliss. Just the sixth sense, the mind, everything else had closed down. Perfectly healthy. It's such a blissful experience. He said the only part of that experience which was unpleasant was the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. She let him have it. She said, don't you ever do that again. You scared me. I thought you were dead. You can imagine that's what it would be like. You know, it's your loved one. You don't know what's really happening. You think, that's it. They're gone. They're dead. You know, but he's having a wonderful time just in his drama. No, it's no thanks for, you know, your compassion. What about me? I'm worried stiff about you. So anyway, that was a true experience. which he told me about in detail. I'll write it in my book, but I checked with him first of all. Is this accurate? He said, yeah. But that was some time ago. Don't know where he's gone now. So, that's what actually happens in these jhanas. But you're perfectly healthy. And in fact, sometimes you get in these states and you feel it afterwards. You're much healthier than when you went in. You may have all sorts of diseases or aches and pains, and you go in afterwards and woof, you feel tremendous. Anyway, from Majjhima 108, this is that Gopakamogalana Sutta. When the Buddha had passed away, just must only be a few weeks afterwards, they asked Ananda. So this, because Ananda was the attendant of the Buddha, this is what he said, and because that happened before the first council, which was 3 or 4 months after the Buddha passed away, they had this in the collection called the Tipitaka. What kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? Totally free from the five senses, you abide in the first jhana. When the mind starts moving on to the joy and pleasure and stops holding it, you abide in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, you abide in the third jhana. With the abandoning of all mental pleasant and unpleasant vedana, you abide in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only praised these four kinds of meditation, the jhanas. And I think I mentioned to you earlier that for a long time, these jhanas, they were basically, I must say, like hidden from the lay community. You weren't supposed to do these. It's just too tough, too hard. But now, over the years I've been a monk, you know, one of the people who used to do those jhanas was Ayakema. You know Ayakema, the nun? You heard of her? And I remember I actually saw her come to time when she was still a lay woman with her husband Gert. But they decided she wanted to go on a spiritual path. But eventually, we invited her to come and visit Bodhinyana Monastery years ago, and I think Ajahn Jaka wasn't here, I invited her to give a talk. So she gave a talk on jhanas. And she said, I probably offended you by talking about jhanas and how important they are. I said, no, I talk about those all the time. But she was quite stunned that, you know, she had another jhana monk who was just promoting them. I said, teaches the lay people as well. Because you find you can do it. Why not? And they were the only meditations the Buddha praised. But what happens now? Because I went to see a couple of very prominent meditation teachers over in the United States. Oh, I don't mind. So I think I'll write about it somewhere. It was Joseph Goldstein and then Jack Kornfield. I couldn't understand. They invited me to have a discussion with their senior teachers. And they were asking me all about jhanas. And jhanas, I thought you people were passionate people. They said, no, our teacher is also, he knows, everybody knows that jhana is important for enlightenment. So they're asking me about all the tips of how to get into jhanas. But they started calling them jhana light. L-I-T-E. They knew it was so important, but it wasn't the real thing. It was almost like a made-up jhana, a lesser jhana. The real jhanas, they blow you away. So anyway, that's the real jhana. It's really incredible stuff. And you can do it. People do it. So anyway, that's what the Buddha praised, those four kinds of meditation, the jhanas. But now, this was a question which many people ask. And this is from the Pasadaka Sutta. There are Chunda. Chunda was the monk who was asking this question. These four kinds of life devoted to pleasure that are entirely conducive to repulsion, to fading away, cessation, peace, realization, enlightenment, and nibbana. What are they? The four jhanas. Lives devoted to pleasure. Now you know the secret of a monk's happiness. I'm devoted to pleasure. But not the sense pleasures, pleasures of the deep meditations. What are they? The four jhanas. So devotees of other sects should say that the Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told yes. For they'll be speaking right correctly of you. And the word addicted, almost like attached to the pleasure of the jhanas. Is that good? Should you be attached to pleasure? What happens if you're attached to the pleasures of the jhanas? This is what the Buddha said. Then some people might further ask, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? You should reply that they can expect only four fruits, four benefits: stream winning, once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment. These are the benefits that you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. That's what monks and nuns are supposed to do. They're supposed to get enlightened. So when you get into the jhanas, yes, they're pleasurable, but they lead to the states of enlightenment. It's not a bad deal, is it? That's why Buddhism took off in the time of the Buddha. Taught people how to meditate, get these incredible states of mind, told you how to do it, and then pleasure, bliss upon bliss upon bliss, and leading to enlightenment. And that's what the Buddha said. So people say, oh, you just get attached to your jhanas. So yeah, you will. And you get enlightened. There's one part only. Oh, this is Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta. This is an interesting sutta because Mahamalunkya Putta was mentioned in another place in the suttas. And Mahamalunkya Putta, I'll do this one first of all. This is Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta, but this is Ananda speaking. When Ananda actually asked the Buddha about Mahamalunkya Putta. There is one path only, Ananda, one way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. That's, you know, the ten fetters. These are the first five fetters. Sakkaya Ditti, that's, you know, like the view of the self. Siddhabhata Paramasa, Vichikicca, doubt, craving for the five sense world, and ill will. If you abandon those five fetters, you are anagami, non-returner. So there is one path only, Ananda, one way to becoming an anagami, to the abandoning of the five basic fetters. It is impossible that anyone can understand or abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. You can't even know what those fetters are, let alone abandon them. No more than it is possible to cut out the hardwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood. What is that path? The four jhanas and the first three immaterial attainments. So that is one of the most powerful statements by the Buddha about maybe stream winning. That's a case which we often discuss as monks, you know, that can you become a stream winner without getting the jhanas? But becoming a non-returner or an arahat, there's no question there. You have to have the jhanas. And otherwise, you can't even cut the hardwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood. And with Mahamalunkya Putta, who this was also taught to, that he was the one, he was the second person, just like the famous Bahiya, who asked the Buddha for some more teachings and was said, in the seen will be just the seen, and the heard just the heard, in the sense, which meant smelt, and tasted, and touched, only that, and in the known, just the known. And at that, Bahiya became fully enlightened. And people think, oh, that's all you need, just to listen to a simple teaching like that, and you get fully enlightened, an arahat. Mahamalunkya Putta heard this teaching first of all, you need jhanas first. And then later on, he got the same teaching from the Buddha. In the seen is just the seen, the heard is the heard. In the sense, just the sense, in the known, just the known. It was that teaching was just the last little straw, the last ingredient having already experienced the jhanas. And this is Nalakapana Sutta. While you still don't experience jhana, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade your mind and remain. When you do experience the jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness, do not invade your mind and remain. They go for a long time. So after a jhana, you know, sometimes if someone gets the jhana, just like if someone thinks they're an arahat or enlightened, sometimes, you know, my job as a teacher is actually to test whether they got discontent. So I just say, sorry, Singapore girls, they cannot get jhanas. See if you get upset by that. Oh yeah, fair enough, whatever. Then it means, okay, you've overcome discontent. And weariness, if you've had a jhana, you can't go to bed and sleep. You go to bed and rest the body, but you've got no tiredness at all. You're full of energy. So that's what happens. The five hindrances and discontent and weariness invade your mind and remain. When you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause of seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion, turning away from the world and fading away, is destroyed. When you are not repulsed nor inclined to disappearing, for one deficient in these, the cause of knowledge and vision of liberation is destroyed. They always say that jhana is the cause of seeing things as they truly are. For two reasons. First of all, it suppresses for long periods of time the five hindrances. So you don't see what you want to see. What challenges you, you have to accept. The aversion is gone, the denial. And also, you have the old simile of a lake in the mountains, which is perfectly still. Only then, if there's not a wave on the surface, can you see the full reflection, undistorted, of the full moon and the stars. I was heard that from Ajahn Chah, but interestingly, that when I was in the demilitarized zone a few weeks ago, and the head meditation master of the Jogji Order, the Korean monk, he did that simile as well. It's part of their tradition. He said, just like going in the mountains, the water has to be perfectly still in the lake. Even a small ripple will distort the reflection. But when it's perfectly still, we mean really still, then you get an undistorted, accurate reflection of the moon and the stars in the sky above. Only when you are still can you see things as they truly are. So the Buddha said, develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. What you will understand as it really is, the origin and passing away of form, the origin and passing away of vedana, origin and passing away of perception, the origin and passing away of will, the origin and passing away of consciousness, it's the five components of existence. And lastly, I've already mentioned this, 372, there is no jhana for one without wisdom. There is no wisdom for one without jhana. For one who has both jhana and wisdom, you are in the presence of nibbana. It's right in front of you. You've got the jhanas. Well, some people had jhanas but no wisdom. People like Devadatta. This is one of the problems with the jhanas. If you don't have the wisdom behind it, especially the non-self, sometimes someone like a Devadatta would experience those jhanas and have some of the powers which often come with them and think that he was as good as, if not superior, than the Buddha and try to take over the community, the Sangha. But as soon as you lose your purity of mind and ego comes in, that is when sort of you lose your jhanas and lose your powers. I did tell you the story of that levitating monk who was invited to the palace and saw the princess. I told that one, didn't I? earlier. You know, he did want to go to the palace, but you know, the king sort of made him an offer he couldn't refuse, as they say. And so he was in the palace grounds. He was doing some exercise, you know, 3 or 4 laps. And that morning, a really beautiful princess brought the food for him. And as he was coming into land, just one look at that princess, one moment of lust came up, and he lost his power to fly. So he had to do crash landing. And imagine that, because that's how sensitive these things are. So if you don't have your right view, you know, you realize what you're doing this for, then sometimes the jhana can make you feel proud. And then you lose your jhanas. But they come with wisdom, with letting go. And there's no wisdom for one without jhana. So one has both jhana and wisdom. You're right next door to Nibbana, it's going to happen. Anyway, there we go. That's jhanas, stillness.
What's the meaning of origin and passing away of form of the five
living? Okay, where does it come from? I know that it comes from there, but what is like, where does your body come from? What keeps it going? What about experience? Why experience? Why does it pass away? Why is it there's noise and sometimes we can't just let it pass away? Why is it it's nothing to do with us, sound? We're sitting there just trying to meditate or meditating and there's a noise there. So what are they doing? Why do they do that? Why is it? It's because we don't just hear sound, we actually go looking for it. Another interesting thing I haven't mentioned yet, you know that sometimes people say, just a thought pops in my mind, you know, when I'm meditating. I always thought that the thoughts come to disturb me, but you realize after a while, no. I actually went looking for the thought. I actually brought it in, something to distract me, something to disturb me. They are not unwanted thoughts, you actually go looking for them. In the same way that, you know, what am I going to do now? Let's, you know, see what's happening in the world, and you turn on the news. It's not that these things, they come to you, you actually go looking for them. Even like sound, what's that got to do with you, what people are talking about? What, the noise, the dogs, nothing to do with you at all. But still we want to listen to it. People meditating, why do I want to look, see who's here? So after a while we find even the thoughts, they are not unwelcome thoughts. You welcome them in. It's weird, but after a bit though, that's what happens. So the thoughts, the senses, you get used to them. That's where you live. And you miss them. You feel uncomfortable if they're not there. It's the old security blanket. The known. What you're accustomed to. Little by little they disappear. Because these are never called jhanas. Sometimes you call them the 4 immaterial jhanas, the arupa states. And so the jhanas always 1, 2, 3, 4. That's all. But what happens, that 4th jhana just mentioned to you is absolute stillness and no sense activity at all. Pleasant or unpleasant mental phenomena. It's just really peaceful and still. What happens when things are peaceful and still? When you're watching a wall and there's nothing's moving, something has to disappear. It's to fade away. So what's happening here, just in brief, is your mind is turning off. It's fading away. All perceptions of space, or consciousness, or thinginess, all those things which make up, you know, the framework for knowing, turn off, one by one. Until the 4th jhana, neither perception nor non-perception, basically you're on the edge of the mind just totally going. And say, well, how can you be aware of the mind when it's not aware? Exactly, that's the fourth immaterial. And then it totally stops. So how can you be aware it totally stopped? You can't be aware it totally stopped. Be aware of what happened just before, what happened just afterwards. So that's how you know the mind has ceased. Well, that is a really, it's this freaky stuff. I'm not holding back for you. So I'm saying, if you can't understand it, just, I can understand that you can't understand it. It's really deep stuff. It's weird stuff. But this is how the Buddha taught. And it's nice you have some framework. And just like I could never understand or even accept Ajahn Chah's simile of the mango orchard, you know, it stayed in my mind, and later on, I said, ooh, that is true. So maybe later on, you know, the immaterial attainments, you understand what they are. The mind is vanishing. The knower. The body goes when you enter the first jhana. The will disappears in the second jhana. And consciousness disappears little by little as you progress through the, or rather ingress through the immaterial. You're turning off. For many people who still hold on to the sense of self, that is the most freaky thing. Because, no, it's too much for me. To experience the fading away of your very existence. You're gone. You're gone, baby. You're gone. I just make that a bit of fun. Because sometimes you get too serious and too deep and people, whoa! So I make a little bit of a joke at the end, but you know, it's a nice joke, it's true. Gone, baby, gone. So anyway, any other questions on that? Okay. Even if you think, oh, it's a bit much, it actually happens. I just did one more simile just to end up, but this is because tomorrow morning, if we give a talk, it'll just be about ending up, a bit of metta and how to take the practice further when you go home. But one of the nice similes, which some of you know, because I tell you every retreat, but I haven't said it yet, which fits in here, is about the donkey and the carrot. Or, if you prefer, the donkey and the durian. This is for Singaporean Buddhists or Indonesians, Malay. So, donkey carts. How can a donkey pull a cart? You may have seen them. They get a stick and they hit the donkey. Really cruel. Waste of time. You can hit the donkey as much as you like. That donkey will not move. That's why in English they have the phrase, as stubborn as a donkey. And so you don't use a stick. Actually, you do use a stick, but in another way. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And on the end of the stick you put a string. And now if you're a Westerner, you put a carrot on the end. If you're from Singapore, Malaysia, you put a durian. Just a segment of durian on the end. So what happens next? That donkey, you know, you beat it, it won't move. But it sees a durian. Oh yeah, that's nice. So the donkey moves towards the durian. And when the donkey moves, the stick moves, the string moves, and the durian moves. So that durian is always about 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. So what does the donkey do? Strives. Puts forth effort. Runs after that durian. Really fast. Doesn't matter how fast the donkey runs. The durian is always about 2 foot, give an inch either way, in front of the donkey's mouth. Does you can see it, you can smell it, it's just right in front of you, you just can't reach it. Does that ring many bells for you about life, meditation, happiness, health? You know, sometimes, you know, if you're into having a family, you see this really nice guy, and you say, go for it. And it's not good enough, it's just almost there. Sometimes life is like that, it's almost perfect, but you always mess up in the end. You can't really capture happiness and security or health. It's almost there, but in the same with spiritual life, meditation, you can see nimitta there. You go for it and it goes away. But in meditation, that we have wisdom. We let go. So what does the donkey do? Been chasing that durian for so many years, so many retreats you've done, as Mrs. Donkey, Mr. Donkey. So what happens? You've been racing after that. There's only one more day to go, even half a day. So what do? You stop. Put on the brakes, you stop. You don't go chasing anything. So what happens to the durian? It starts swinging away from you. It doesn't work, I jump on. Confidence. Like, I know my profession. I'm a very well-known meditation teacher. Have a bit of faith and trust. Let go. So donkey is wise enough. Okay, I jump on, says let go, so I'll let go. And that durian gets further and further away from the donkey's mouth. Really long way. He's never been so far away from the donkey's mouth. Your meditation's falling apart, getting nothing. Restless, sleepiness, no limiters, nothing. Just fantasies, dreams. It gets 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And then something happens, weird. It goes 4 foot, and then the durian starts swinging towards you. You're not doing anything, you're not striving. And then you start to get delightful breath. I never did that. I just let go. And that durian gets even closer. It's its usual place, 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, but now it's kind of at top speed towards the donkey's mouth. Gets closer. Limiters, really good ones. Wow, amazing limiters. Jhanas. There's a durian gets closer and closer and closer, and at the very end, it's almost swinging into the donkey's mouth. The last thing which the donkey must always remember, please remember this, donkeys. Just as the durian gets close, you know how big the teeth of donkeys are? The donkey must remember metta, loving kindness. As the durian gets very close, the donkey must remember, durian, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise, it bounces off the teeth. And then the durian comes into the donkey's mouth. Enlightenment. That's how it works. You go and chase these things, and they're always 2 foot away. You stop, out, in. Enlightenment. That's how the donkey catches durians. Sadhu. Oh, sorry for mentioning durians this time of night, but don't worry, tomorrow you'll be home and get a durian. Very good.